This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. And suddenly, for the vast majority of teams, the end of the season is upon us. Just three more weekends to go, and for some, relief that they're over the line.
We're literally about to restart the game, and then obviously we get news at the game. Our supporters start cheering, so then we realise that we've been promoted. So then there's actually an extra lull in the game because it's only natural to start celebrating.
We'll recognise one of the EFL's community champions of the year.
We see ourselves very much of using the badge in terms of education and enablement for community groups in all of the EFL Trust projects and programmes.
And back on the field, we'll meet the Sky Bet Championship manager whose team are fighting to avoid the drop.
As with every manager, and Richie Wellens will allude to it, you just need a little bit of time to get your stamp on things and get your players and then get your staff in the right position. And that's what I believe can happen at this football club.
It's the official EFL podcast. Where better to start this episode than in Sky Bet League 2 by congratulating Leighton Orient. After Burnley, they're the second EFL team this season to achieve promotion, something that, in my opinion, has looked entirely likely for the whole campaign, although head coach Richie Wellens may disagree. Honestly, Richie, when did you know you were onto something?
I think more or less straight away before I got the job, just because the owners were really good. And I'm working for a director of football in Martin Ling that was so easy to work with. Obviously, he's been a manager himself, so he knows the stresses and strains of the job. And he just allowed me to work with a freedom. We finished last season off really, really well. And we showed signs that potentially we could do something this season. We then started to recruit. We got four or five players in, and our start was incredible. 9 wins and 1 draw from the first 10. Obviously, amazing. Put us in a position where we didn't have to. We could afford a blip, but we probably drew a few games where we probably could have gone for the win. But the situation that we was in and the position we was in, we knew that if we just kept keeping the points tally ticking over, then we would get to where we want to get to.
Because, Richie, so much of being involved football in the main involves striving to achieve something. And because you did have that almost unprecedented start, did you have to switch your own mindset into how to manage the guys? Because, you know, there's a difference between trying to get somewhere versus trying to stay somewhere.
Not really, because we set goals and targets in pre-season, and all them goals and targets was at the end of the season. So the fact that you've got 28 points from 30 has not really achieved anything. So sometimes psychologically, when you set targets and you reach them, some part of your brain can then switch off and you don't quite get the extra target. So we've never set, in terms of a 10-game block, we've never set any targets. It was always, this is what we want to achieve at the end of the season. So I think it's quite easy to carry on your mindset that you haven't achieved anything after 10 games. We congratulate the players because it's the best ever start from any League 2 club ever, which is a magnificent achievement. But then we just, after them 10 games, to reset and make sure that the end goal is the one that we get.
Have you, it seems like a stupid question, but I know how you guys suffer, and obviously half the EFL managers now with Mike Flynn's departure from Walsall today, half the EFL managers have changed this season. Have you enjoyed it, Richie? Or are you so consumed with it and the next game that you don't have time to?
No, I suppose every manager is different, and it'd be interesting to actually have a poll. When you're at the bottom, you're under pressure to win, to get away from the bottom. And when you win every week, the pressure is to win the next game and the next game and the next game. So I don't think, you know, we drew 2-2 at home to Harrogate 3 games ago. We got booed off. And it's like, really? We were 2-0 up. We should have been out of sight. We just beat Salford away. We just beat Carlisle at home. So we got 6 points from them games. So the fact that a point at home to Harrogate, 7 points from them 3 games would have been really, really good. But the fact that you dropped the 2 points to the lowest place club is seen as a negative. So, listen, in football, supporters, pundits, social media. Everybody has hindsight. And with hindsight, we can all be the best manager in the world. It's a really difficult job. I've got immense respect for all managers. The ones that have done it for 15, 20, like to have your Neil Warnock, Nigel Pearce, you have a huge amount of respect for him. It's not easy. But I do think as you evolve and you get more games under your belt, you do become you become used to it and you become more consistent. You're not up and down. You can be a little bit erratic in your first couple of seasons. So I do think, especially young English managers, a Premier League manager once said to me, you're not a manager until you've got to 100 games. Get to 100 league games and you can start calling yourself a manager. I do think them first 100 can be difficult.
Now, listen, we're catching you just less than 24 hours after the final whistle at Gillingham. I think we can sense that it's taken it out of you. Your voice is sounding a little bit hoarse. I mean, first of all, what bizarre circumstances to get promoted after a rare-ish defeat this season, but also that you find out during a lull in the game because the floodlights failed with, or the lights failed with 12 minutes to go. I mean, so, mind you, this is your party piece. I mean, your last promotion when you were in charge of Swindon was in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. So I don't know what that says about you, mate.
Yeah, no, nothing's ever easy, is it? And our supporters was at Leighton Orient, we always make it difficult. Nothing's ever easy, blah, blah. Well, we've won promotion with, what is it, 4 games left?
Yeah.
But then when the lights failed last night, it's like, Jesus Christ, maybe the supporters are right. It's not easy. But I'd love to say that I had a lot to drink last night, and this is hence why my throat is sore. It's not, Clem, the referee last night was that poor. That's why my throat's killing me. So anyway, we'll leave that. I just think that when you celebrate like that, it's surreal. The lights have just gone out.
Yeah.
You know that there's 10 minutes of the game left. We're waiting for the Swindon result in because the other two teams, Stevenage and Northampton, have won. And then we're about to kick off and it's 90 plus 10 at Swindon v Bradford. We're literally about to restart the game, and then obviously we get news at the game, our supporters start cheering, so then we realise that we've been promoted, so then there's actually an extra lull in the game because it's only natural to start celebrating. So, really, really surreal. But we do have 2 home games now, which obviously gives us another opportunity to celebrate.
I get that, but because it was not only the 11 that were on the field that were celebrating, but all the subs came on, the backroom staff and everything. Did you have to ask permission from 4th to come running on the field? Because you know what the game's like these days. You all go piling on like that and stuff. Did you have permission?
So what it was is the lights have come back on. Yeah. The referee then pulled myself and Neil Harris and said, are you happy just to kick off straight away without any warm-up? We said, yeah, let's just crack on. It's getting on now. We knew that we'd lost the game. We were down to 10 men. And then the referee then decides to go off with his 4th official and the 2 linesmen, and then leaves us stood outside for another 10 minutes. So it wasn't like we've run on the pitch and the referee's out. The referee was actually off the pitch as well.
Okay, gotcha. Your emotion when you realise, I suppose you're still trying to manage the game, make sure you don't get done for 3s or 4s and stuff, but if not when you knew from the crowd, or maybe as the final whistle went and you're out there on the field, what's swilling around you, Richie? What are you feeling?
Immense pride. But, you know, I really bought into Leighton Orient as a club. I'd look back and what the club had gone through with the Italian owners, being relegated from League One, being relegated from League Two, having players on huge, huge wages. And then Nigel and Kent taking over, saving the club. The club didn't even have a bank account. It was in a really poor, poor state. And then they get their act together. They get a good manager in Justin Edinburgh to get them promoted from the National League. And then his death just rocked the club. So you imagine being involved in a club, whether it be a player, whether it be the board member, a member of staff, to have someone that you have such affection for lose their life while they've just achieved something great for the club. So immense pride. I'm pleased for someone like Martin Ling, who, when the owners took over, they had a 6-year plan to get it into League One. This was a 6-year. So I was under a little bit of pressure from that, but they did supply me a budget which was about around seventh in the league. So it did give me a chance. You know, Martin Ling was under a little bit of pressure when I went in there from the outside. I thought that Martin was doing a good job. But then when you get into the nitty-gritty of your daily job, you understand that Martin Ling's under a little bit of pressure. I'm pleased for him, probably as much as anybody, because what he does for me is fantastic. Obviously, he does all the contracts and recruitment. And what I can only comment on the last 15 months and what he has done has been fantastic. He's helped me a lot, so I'm really pleased for him.
Are you pleased too that you've done it as a team? Because unlike a heck of a lot of teams that get promoted, no absolutely hugely prolific goal scorer in there. We do see that time and time again, don't we? That there's normally a number nine in there that's banging in 20 plus. But you haven't needed to rely on one individual.
Yeah, maybe that's me as well being a little bit stubborn, because when we won the league at Swindon, we had so much good play. We had a really, really good team. But Owen Doyle scored 28 and Jerry H scored 16. So everybody was just like, oh, you've only won the league because them two score goals. It was a lot more than that. So we had an opportunity in January to get a striker in, but we had two lads in Aaron Drinan and who has not been fit for the majority of the season, and Charlie Kelman, who has a possibility to be a really, really good player. He's 20, 21 years old, worked his socks off. And I just thought, you know what? I can still win the league without a striker because of the work ethic of the team. Defensively, the way that we play, we'll still get us enough points to get where we want to do. What I didn't want to do is get a striker in that could potentially score us 10, 12 goals from January till the end of the season. But then the dynamics of the team changed, so I didn't want to risk that.
Some lovely shots from the dressing room. And one of the shots is the boys all singing Wagon Wheel, which I think I'm right in saying was written by Bob Dylan back in the day, unless I'm mistaken, but recorded by Darius Rucker 10 years ago. And you've just let on to us before we pressed record on this week's episode of the Official EFL podcast that a few guys in the dressing room were quite religious. And so they that song in particular and one other are born out of that kind of become club, well, team anthems as such.
Yeah, so he's that Wagon Wheel, and then he's another one. I think it's a church basement, which is on all the time. Actually, the first song that is played whenever we arrive in a changing room at home or away is actually the EastEnders theme tune.
Is it really?
It's a bit embarrassing, but they walk in within East London, they put the EastEnders tune on full blast, and then they put Wagon Wheel and the church basement one. But George Moncur is the guy who sorts the music out. Very, very religious lad. And then we've actually got now probably maybe up to 12, 15 players that are quite religious. We have a prayer group, but we embrace it. I think it's fantastic. So we've got a little surprise for George come the last game of the season. Don't tell him anything. But, when you stood in a dressing room surrounded by 20 lads, 10, 15 staff, and then that song comes out and you understand the background to it, then it does become quite emotional.
You've got a surprise for George Moncur. You're either going to get Jesse Wallace from EastEnders to come in the dressing room, or you're going to fly Darius Rucker over. Actually, he's on tour, I believe. I'm making out like I know a lot about him. I checked who had recorded that version of this. I'll say no more. Let's just make sure George Moncur doesn't listen to this particular episode. I got to ask you, Rich. I mentioned this stat already. Half the EFL managers changed this season. I mean, it's bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I mean, I guess we get runs of form. For poor Mike Flynn, who's the latest, it's one league win in 20. An owner has a right to change. But, I mean, not only that, Richie. So it's 36 clubs and 10 clubs across the three divisions have changed their manager twice.
It's hard for me to say because I get it. I do understand it, that these owners have put their money in and they want to see a certain thing. But, you know, the owners of Walsall must have got... I know Flinney well. I love Flinney to bits. I played with Flinney and obviously managed against him. And they've given him probably 12, 15 players. So now you're going to sack him and a new manager might come in and not want them 15 players. And then No, I had it at Salford where I inherit a group of players and never got any time to change the feeling, the mentality, the way that we was playing. The one that really hits me was Darrell Clarke. I think that's, I mean, come on. He took over. And people always question managers' loyalty.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll be getting asked questions probably in the next four to 6 weeks. Are you going to stay? Are you going to do this? Are you whatever. Because when you get success, obviously, interest from other clubs then starts to happen. And you as a manager want certain things. We at Leyton Orient, I took over in 20th. Darrell Clarke took over in 18th. He took Port Vale to Wembley. He had horrific circumstances in his private life and then signed a five-year deal. Surely his remit within that five-year deal is to go up to League One and stay up. With all due respect to Port Vale, they cannot go up like a... For example, if Ipswich go up to the Championship with the financial muscle, they could probably give it a go to go again. Port Vale can't compete with Derby, Ipswich, Portsmouth, Chapley can't compete. So surely staying in League One is the first stepping block to then build your club in League One. And Darrell would have kept them up. I think the 6 points clear. And he would have kept them up. So to change is just... So whenever supporters say you loyalty, this, that, the other, you know, I think sometimes clubs have to look at themselves. I recently signed a new contract at Leyton Orient on the basis that certain things are put in line and everything is in black and white about what our achievements are like. Short term, medium term, and then obviously you sign a three-year deal, what it looks like after 3 years, because I just think it's too... And I've seen Vincent... I'm going on too long now. Sorry, Clem.
No, you're not. This is what you're on for, and we want these opinions. Please continue.
Yeah, I seen Vincent Kompany's interview when he spoke about Patrick Vieira. Patrick Vieira's just gone through Manchester City twice, Man United, Arsenal, and played all his games, and he's not won in 7-8 games. Give him the opportunity to play against the teams in and around him. Roy Hodgson is a fantastic man. He's gone and he's won them games, and it looks brilliant for Roy, and it looks really bad for Patrick. But that was probably coming. Crystal Palace have really, really good players who can win games against the bottom 12 of the Premier League. What they can't do is compete with Arsenal, Man City twice, Manchester United, Chelsea on a consistent basis when you're playing so close together. I think it's really, really difficult for managers. I don't care who you are. Every manager has a blip. I had a blip in January through with Leyton Orient. So Alex Ferguson had a blip for 3 years at Manchester United. And he's the best manager this country's ever seen. So I do think that if... You develop your relationship from the owner to manager and you come through these blips, it gives you confidence and it you know that the next blip coming, that the owners are going to back you. So you make clear decisions and decisions for the benefit of the long term for the team and the club. When you feel as you're under pressure, you make rash decisions, what impacts the next 24 hours, the next 48 hours, the next game. And I think that's totally the wrong way to go about it.
I mean, I'm going to stress that both Richie and I have both said we respect the right that the owner of a club has the right to do what they want with their club. But I'm just saying that half the clubs changing their managers and 10 of them doing it twice, that cannot in every circumstance just be bad management. There's got to be more to it in a lot of those situations, and the managers become the scapegoat. I want to talk about your kind of rivals this season, Richie. Just before I do, this Saturday's coming fixtures then in Sky Bet League 2. Carlisle in 5th, 1-8. They go to Barrow. Bradford in 6th, first defeat in 12, led to Leyton Orient being promoted. They entertain Gillingham, who are now safe from relegation. There's a huge game at the bottom. 23rd placed Hartlepool are 3 points behind Crawley Town in 22nd, who they entertain. Richie's Leyton Orient are at home to Crewe. Stevenage in 3rd go to 8th place Mansfield, are 4 points clear of 4th with 4 games left. Northampton in 2nd are 5 points clear of 4th with 3 games left. They entertain Harrogate. If I tell you that Stockport in 4th are at home to Rochdale, must win all 3 to stand any chance of maintaining their EFL status. And Walsall, without Mike Flynn, who has been sat, entertained 7th placed Salford. Both Northampton and Stevenage could go up this weekend if Stockport and Carlisle slip up. It's been a right ding-dong-do between, well, certainly the three of you. You'd have to add Carlisle into the mix over the last 2-3 months. And obviously Stockport have been roaring up as well. It's been fabulous from the outsider's point of view, Richie.
Yeah, no, I must admit, with Stockport's budget and the way that Dave got them going in the second half of the season, I did think they was a real, real threat.
Yeah.
But like we spoke about getting through adversity before, John Brader, the last day of last season was ridiculous. The fact that he should be home and knows Scunthorpe beat should have more pride not to get beat 7-0 on the last day of the season.
Yeah.
And for him to come back from that, he suffered injuries this year, especially in the last 10 games. He's come through that and now he's in a really good spot. So congratulations to him. Steve Evans and Stevenage beat us. In and around January, we was going through transition where we had a lot of injuries and then integrating new players, and they beat us up. They beat us 3-0, well-deserved on the day. And then they went on a really bad run. But it looks like Steve has turned that round and now I'm got them going again. No team has had it all smooth all season. So I think Northampton and Stevenage are the favourites to come up with us. So, obviously not congratulations, but I do like it when managers suffer and then they come out the other end. So Steve's done a great job there. Very similar to when we came in. We was fighting relegation last year and Stevenage was one of them teams that potentially could go down. And as soon as Steve got the job at Stevenage, I said to my assistant, Paul Terry, he said, count them out. They're not going down. Steve will keep them up. So, them two teams have had a fantastic season. I think it'll probably be them two.
On the subject of going through hardship, is there there's an immense amount of pride that you've won promotion clearly with two different clubs. That's a real feel-good factor. You had a bit of a tough time with your 6 months at Salford, your 6 months at Doncaster. Redemption's probably too strong a word, but I can't find a more appropriate one. Is there something in there that, you know, it gives you a self-confidence boost that, given the right circumstances, you now know you're a darn good manager?
I think you deep down, you have confidence in yourself. I'd like you to look it up. I took Swindon 19th to win the league within 14 months and later on it from 20th to automatic promotion in 13 months. So I'd like to think that I know what I'm doing. The Salford one I've learnt from, I wasn't myself. I managed upwards really, really poorly. You know, and I took solace from that and a lot of reflection. And I think that job helped me in this job. To be honest, Clem Doncaster, I was swimming with no arms and no legs. And again, you look at the managers before me. Andy Butler, it was really, really tough for him. He won 3 in 25. Darren Moore's last 6 games at Doncaster when the loan players went, and Ben Whiteman left the club, was sold to Preston. He drew 1, lost 5. He seen what was coming. He seen Sheffield Wednesday on the rise and he couldn't wait to get out. Then it was Andy Butler. Then it was me. Then it was Gary McSheffrett. Really tough for Gary in his first job. The club are relegated. And now Danny Schofield has gone in. And I like the way that Danny coaches. But if you don't have players, Clem, if you don't have a budget, I'm paying lads £400-£500 a week in League One. I'm playing Sheffield Wednesday away and Barry Bannon's on the whole of my budget. You can be the best manager in the world. I guarantee you, for me, Pep Guardiola is the best manager he's ever been. Look at the clubs he manages. And when he's got a problem at right back, do you know what he does, Clem? He goes and spends £50 million on a right back. And when he needs a goalkeeper, he goes and spends £60 million on a goalkeeper. He's brilliant at interacting them big egos and getting to play different styles, and he's fantastic at it. But if you don't have the players, it's a really, really hard job. Football for me is all about players. Are they coachable? Are they dedicated? Are they adaptable? And have they got enough quality? And for me, if you mix all that in a pot, if you're a manager and you have all of that and you don't get success, then you're a poor, poor manager. But if you're given the opportunities and you get results, like a Pep does, you look at Jurgen Klopp. Fantastic, fantastic. Load of injuries at Liverpool in the last 6-8 months. They're 8th in the league. He's the same manager. It's all about players, Clem. And if anybody tells you any different, there's young lads now that want to go on his coaching management journey and he want to rip it up and invent things that are not. It's all about players. You can come in with these ideas and you can have this brilliant thing in your mind. how do I transition this across to my players? Great. But the players can't do it. You need to be adaptable. And you need to manipulate and manage yourself around certain situations. And for me, that's what I've done. Is Leighton Orient the team that I want it to be? No. I think we've got another level, a couple of levels that we can go. We can get better. But with the players that we have, we've tried to maximise and squeeze everything out of them possible. And I think that in itself is what a good manager is. Sean Dyche is an outstanding manager. His win rate in the Premier League will be 30% at Burnley. If you write it down saying your win rate is 30%, people, what, 30%? You have a win rate at Burnley in the Premier League and you keep Burnley up. Brilliant. Brilliant. So it's all about, you know, what have you got to work with? What can you achieve? And for me, I took a team over. Paul Cook once said to me, Rich, try and always take a job. He's a football pyramid. Yeah, at the time, Manchester City was number one and Macclesfield is number 90, right? Try and take a job where you have room to work with that pyramid. I took over at Swindon, which was 88th in that pyramid. Swindon should never be 88th. I left them, who was about 60th in that pyramid. Leighton Orient was about, again, 89th in the pyramid. And now they're going to move up 20 places in that pyramid. If you go in, I think Matt Taylor at Rotherham has done a fantastic job. You're taking over at Rotherham, a really good club, but he's been a yo-yo club and Paul Warner's always struggled to keep him in a championship. Looks like Matty Taylor's going to keep him in a championship. He's not got much room to work within that pyramid, but he's keeping him stable. For me, he's done an excellent job.
You've set that up perfectly because Matt Taylor's going to join us a little bit later on this episode of the Official EFL podcast. Just before I finish off by asking you about preparing for life at Division Higher next season, let me just remind people in Skybet League One this coming weekend, the state of play. Fourth place Barnsley are at home to Oxford United. No league win in 16 matches, their worst run since the 1980s. Fifth place Bolton at home to Shrewsbury. Morecambe in 22nd go to Charlton. Forest Green Rovers, relegated last weekend, 6 wins from 43 this season. They are at Cheltenham. It's Derby against Burton Albion. Derby just outside the playoff places. Sixth place Peterborough entertain Ipswich, who are second. They're a point clear of Sheffield Wednesday. They've won 10 of their last 11. I say a point clear of Sheffield Wednesday with a game in hand. Plymouth, who are top, 2 points clear of Sheffield with a game in hand as well. They're at home to Bristol Rovers. Sheffield themselves, after 2 wins in 3 after 6 without, they entertain Exeter City. I should say on Tuesday night, those games in hand take place in Skybet League One. That's Ipswich travelling to Barnsley and Plymouth at home to Bristol Rovers. I mean, you'll have had concurrent strategy going on in terms of recruitment preparation for next season, Richie, have you? Or has it been pretty much preparation since January for where to go once we kick off again in August?
No, not really, because we had a plan in January and then we got ripped up 2 games before the window because we got 2 centre-halves out for a long time and Omar Beckel's got a 3-game ban. So it ripped our January transfer plans open, and we needed to, instead of what we wanted, we needed to replace a centre-back. We've had discussions on certain things, but before we do anything, we need to make sure that we've offered contracts to certain players. We're still at the club, we're waiting on decisions. I think we can push now for them decisions because the players are always using it. Oh, Gaffer, wait until we know what league we're in, blah, blah, blah. Just trying to buy a bit of time. I've been there. But now we need to push them and we need answers, because the quicker we get answers, the quicker we can plan. We're in a pretty privileged position because we've probably got a 3-week start on especially 2 teams, and we've probably got a 5-week start on whoever goes up from the playoffs. So I think we need to use that.
Yeah, most definitely. Mate, I'm absolutely delighted for you. What will it take to establish Leighton Orient in the next division?
Again, consistent messages. You know, everybody singing from the same hymn sheet. If you can go and spend a load of money on certain players, but if the infrastructure and the foundations are not right below them players, then it's never going to work. So I'm quite relaxed about it. We will have a budget that will, you know, if we can finish mid-table, it'd be a fantastic season. But I think there's a big jump from League League Two to League One. I think there's an even bigger jump from the bottom of League One to the top of League One. You get a real big mix in League One. A lot of teams that have come up from non-league, the likes of Fleetwood, Accrington, Cambridge, all of them have been flickering in non-league, League Two, and done great to get to League One. But then you get the monsters that have been in the Premier League, and it's a really difficult league. So it's probably the first time I'm ever going to go into League One where I have a a budget that can compete. I've always had probably the lowest budget in the league, and I'm finding it really tough. Can't get players to sign and all of that. So there's no excuses going forward.
Mate, I am delighted for you. Tell me that once you've got the title secure, you will allow yourself a little half of lager and you will take the missus and the family away for a little bit of a break and just press the reset and have a refresh, won't you?
No, I think that's important for any manager. I mean, I see managers on holiday and some of them got the phone in the hand. Why? You've got director of football. So I'll say to Lingy, I go away on the 21st, I take the family to Dubai. No one ring me because my phone won't be off. I might have an hour where I'm on the sun lounge and just check a few things, check who's signing what or whatever's happening. But if any agents ring me, I'll just put them on to Martin Ling, Steve Foster. And you need a break because otherwise, you know what? You go do lally, Clem.
Are you a sun worshipper? Does Richie Wellens on holiday, is he in his trunks on his sun lounge just soaking up the sun, or do you light the parasol? Do you read a book? Do you listen to music? How do you relax on holiday?
No, it's quite weird because I've actually changed. When I was younger, when I had young kids, I wanted to put some oil on. I wanted to sit in the sun for 6-7 hours, and I wanted to get a real good tan to go back home with. And the kids are like, "Come on, Dad, come and play." And I was like, "Just give us 5. Now, the kids are older and can go off and do what they want. Now I find it really difficult to sit in the sun for a long, long period of time. So, yeah, it's swung.
Mate, listen, good luck getting the title secure. Congratulations on your magnificent achievement. Thanks, Richie.
Cheers, Clem. Top man.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
This week, the EFL's Community Awards took place at the Houses of Parliament, with clubs and players recognised for their outstanding work over the past year. Full list of winners can be found on the EFL's website. We can speak now to Marilyn Smith from MK Dons Sport and Education Trust. They were the Sky Bet League One divisional winners of the Project of the Season for their Knife Angel anti-violence campaign. Knife Angel. We'd better just outline for people exactly what we mean by that.
Okay. It's the National Monument Against Violence and Aggression, and it's a 27-foot tall, that's just over 8 metres, sculpture which was designed using 100,000 knives that have been gathered in through stop and search, through raids, amnesty bins, things like that. And within it, it has over 80 families where a knife, which has had an inscription on, have actually contributed to the sculpture. And it's in the form of an angel with wings and quite an imposing statue that stands and is used as a prompter for conversations and engagement with the community.
My ears are drawn to the word national and why it therefore ended up within Milton Keynes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sculpture that's been touring around the UK, and at the beginning of 2022, we had a number of deaths related to knife crime in Milton Keynes, and that kind of put a shockwave through the community in terms of needing to do something to prevent it escalating. And the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Assistant Chief Constable made a decision that they were keen to host the Angel in Milton Keynes. And I got involved in terms of saying, really think you should put this at the stadium, because we have such a huge footfall around the site on a regular basis that it would be a shame for us not to be involved and using the badge as a catalyst for engaging people. So that's why it came to Milton Keynes originally. And it's a bit of a Marmite sculpture, and that some people don't like it because it suggests that there's a knife crime problem, and others recognise it's a tool for good in terms of being able to talk to people about the issues around knife crime and aggression in communities.
I confess that when I think of Milton Keynes, and obviously I've been to your club, I don't know, a dozen times over my time as a broadcaster, also done some other bits and pieces of filming around. We're a city, aren't we? We are a city.
We are now, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, this year in the city, yeah.
Yeah, good. Good geographical knowledge there. I must confess, I think of leafiness and a bright, young, developing city. I guess that it is that balance, isn't it, between trying to subdue the problem that you have, like the social problems the whole of the UK has, v not making people think that MK Milton Keynes is an unsafe place to live.
Absolutely. I mean, we were really conscious of that in terms of the way we designed our education programmes, was first of all to reassure young people and communities that Milton Keynes is a safe city. But in order to make it stay safe, you need to kind of have some education and demystify people around, you know, this perception that carrying a knife keeps you safe, that actually you're less likely to be hurt if you carry a knife. Well, of course, that's rubbish. And that most people that actually carry knives, they're often the victims in those situations. And that the long-term implications of being stopped and found to be carrying a knife has a long-term effect on your career pathways, your opportunities as an adult going forward as well. So we were looking at that stance and also thinking with young people about how they could become ambassadors to encourage others to take a similar path and be against violence and against carrying knives across the city as well.
Marilyn, I just want to be clear I've understood this. What you're basically saying is a hefty proportion of youngsters carrying knives are doing so as a self-defense mechanism, as a sort of repellent to those who might attack them. But as a result, they get either sucked into being the victim of violence, or as you say, it can have quite catastrophic effect on their life just by implication.
Absolutely. There are lots of facts out there which indicate that if you carry a knife, then there's a good chance that you'll be hurt by the knife if you use it in an aggressive situation. And if you're carrying it as a form of protection, it's a self, you know, a false sense of security, and that potentially that actually puts you in greater risk of things escalating out of control than it would be if you didn't have that knife. And you're more likely to move away from the scenario than if you're in a confrontation and you're carrying. So those were the kinds of conversations we were having, trying to demystify the kind of the information that young people carry with them around the use of knives. Everything from young people thinking that there are safe places to stab someone where they won't die. And all those kind of misconceptions, misunderstanding is what we were trying to address within the education pathway with teenagers of young people. And for our primary age, in terms of looking at peer pressure, looking at violence, not just in terms of knife crime, but broader violence, that can be experienced in communities and families as well. So the whole education pathway, we work with just over 3,500 school-aged children to kind of provide them education around knife crime and how to keep safe. And that was kind of a legacy of this work.
I mean, I don't want to be too mawkish here, but I'm imagining that during the research and development part of educating those 3,500 youngsters and agreeing to put the statue at the stadium, you would come across some pretty devastating stories of families that have been decimated as a result of knife crime.
We did indeed. In fact, we worked with a number of families, including one family in particular who were very heavily involved in fact, volunteered every day. The Knife Angel was with us at the stadium and supported with some of our education tools. And has continued to be involved beyond the Knife Angel in working with us on a legacy program, which is around trauma kits for taxi companies, for venues around the city, so that if anybody experiences a serious bleed, that there is a kit there next to the defibrillator that they can use to try and keep somebody alive, basically, while emergency services kind of come in attendance. So they've been involved right the way through the program in terms of that delivery and messaging around why it's important, not just for the individual directly involved in a knife crime, but the impact on families and communities as a result of knife crime as well.
Do we underestimate the effect that having your players as ambassadors can have on the next generation?
I think you can never underestimate just how important players are in terms of messaging around all sorts of issues. We were lucky enough to have full engagement by the whole stadium group here at Milton Keynes. So we had players and coaches on every single tour that we did with young people at the stadium. They shared their own personal stories around family members or friends that they know had experienced knife crime and were really keen to promote the whole concept of becoming an ambassador against knife crime as well.
The statue itself is still with you and still with you to the end of the season?
No, sadly not. You get the knife angel for a month. And we saw this very much as just a catalyst to get that conversation started. So our work continues and we're still doing work with schools, with prisons, with youth groups, all sorts of people around kind of anti-violence. But we had the knife angel with us from December before it moved on then to Slough. During that time, we managed to engage 50,000 people in meaningful conversations around anti-violence. So it's a fantastic tool for engaging people around this issue.
Yeah, that's an astonishing number. I have to say as well that there is a video out there showing your own involvement with Knife Angel, and well, as a piece of art as well, I should say it is worth looking at because it's a very impressive work. It's also very scary and I've only seen it remotely, when the camera moves in and you do see the blades and imagine the damage all those knives could have done. Do you know what? As I sit here, I'm once again in awe of the work that EFL clubs do in their community, that those of us that love the game, even those of us like myself that have the privilege to work in the game, just have no awareness of, Marilyn.
Yeah, it's a lot going on. Lots of opportunities for communities to engage with football clubs around all sorts of issues and subjects. And we see ourselves very much of using the badge in terms of education and enablement for community groups in all of the EFL Trust projects and programmes. So we just feel really privileged that we're able to use that badge as a way of developing partnerships in terms of delivery with people like Thames Valley Police and with community organisations who want to work alongside us. And that gives us a really powerful position to affect significant changes for communities.
Marilyn, we've got to offer you our congratulations. Thanks for explaining. Keep up the great work, and we appreciate you joining us on the Official EFL podcast.
Thank you.
And it goes without saying, if you have been affected by knife crime, you have our sympathy. Please do, if you feel as though you want to make a difference in your communities, please do look up the great work that MK Dons have been doing. If you'd like to see a full list of all this year's community award winners, you can go to www.efl.com. That's www.efl.com. Spectacular, Marilyn. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The Official EFL Podcast with Mark Clement.
To the battle to stay in the Sky Bet Championship, Rotherham United are one of five teams from them in 18th to Reading in 22nd, currently separated by just 3 points. We can talk to manager Matt Taylor. I can't help but feel, Matt, that this must be all consuming, isn't it, when you reach this point of the season when the stakes are so high and the margins are so fine? It must be in your head just about all the time.
It is, but no different to the start of the season, no different to the middle of the season. Any manager will tell you that your footballing thoughts are never far away from you. And obviously in terms of the pressure everyone feels towards the end of the season, knowing what's at stake, you still have to find a way to find some sort of enjoyment and satisfaction in the work you're doing. As long as the players are given absolutely everything, which I'm sure all players are at all different levels, including our own, then you can sit there comfortable in the knowledge that you're doing everything you possibly can. But as it ramps up game by game and you get closer and closer to, is it squeaky bum time at the end of the season? We all know what's coming.
Yeah, you've still got a smile on your face. Obviously, you like to do things all at once because you'd got your son came along just at the point you were moving as well. That's a big lifestyle change, is it not? Because I know in previous conversations we've had, you'd really bought in to life down in Exeter, and then suddenly you've got, I guess, family a little bit closer, etc.
Yeah, look, I had a fantastic time down at Exeter. A great place to live. The Southwest was excellent to me in terms of the upbringing and the understanding in terms of my footballing career as a player, and then my coaching career and managerial career as well. So, well, I really enjoyed my time down there. But when the opportunity to manage at Championship level came around, and this is no disrespect to Exeter, I knew there was a ceiling leaving Exeter as a club. So I felt it was the right opportunity. I wasn't going to get many of those opportunities because it's so difficult for any young English manager to progress through the leagues unless you get promoted with the team you're working for. And that opportunity came up. Coincidentally, the young man was 6 weeks old at the time. So we had a big decision to make as a family. But we committed to it. And we're so pleased we did because we're loving our time in Yorkshire.
Yeah, I think one of the statistics I always quote people is, for most people in normal jobs, if you move roles, even for a similar role, let's say a head teacher moving from one school to another school, they reckon the standard ramp-up time to be fully in your groove is 9 to 12 months. And yeah, I think, you know, you moved, you declared your hand on a Monday and were taking the team on the Wednesday. I mean, football is nuts, is it not, in comparison to everything else?
It is. It's absolutely nuts, but we absolutely love it. Everyone who's involved in football gets that enjoyment and that satisfaction out of it. I've got all my friends are teachers. Everyone who I did my degree with at Sheffield Hallam University, they went on to teach, and then some of those are head teachers as well. And they're envious of the jobs we have, understandably so. And I'm not saying that that's a downgrade on the teaching profession, but they want to work in football. They want to understand what the lifestyle's like. They want to understand what the pressure's like. The changes which you've just alluded to, you never know when they're going to happen. You can get sacked in the space of 24 hours. You can get offered jobs elsewhere. You can lose players through injury. It's constantly changing and evolving. And it's never boring. And we're certainly living a lifestyle which is full in terms of what we encounter on a daily basis. But there's always that belief that when the Saturday comes or the Tuesday night comes, whenever the fixtures come and you're stood on the touchline, that team represents what you're all about.
Are you, when you are not playing, because obviously you had your draw on Tuesday night against Burnley, and then there were games as we speak last night as we're recording this. Are you very much looking all the time and torturing yourself with, oh, they've dropped in the bottom three, and oh yeah, no, they're behind? Or are you a kind of, right, I'm going to get away from this and just take it all as one hit at the final whistle, albeit a couple of the teams playing as we speak last night, you've got a face in the next week. What's your strategy on that front?
Look, you can't not look at results. You can't not know about what's going on.
No, I
elsewhere.
Wasn't saying that. What I meant was, are you literally looking constantly with your phone in your hand or watching one of the programs and the stuff's coming in? So every single goal that goes in that has a consequence, you're taking that hit.
No, I've got too many other things going on. And if I'm not looking after the little man, then I'm watching games elsewhere. I was at the Middlesbrough game last night, Middlesbrough Hull game. So it's a constant in terms of the way you work through the week. And distractions are good distractions. As soon as the final whistle went against Burnley on Tuesday night, it was straight home, do a little bit of work post-game. And then Wednesday daytime was daddy daycare. And then Wednesday evening, I was back working, going to the Middlesbrough game. So it's a constant, but like I said, alluded to earlier, you can't not see what else is happening elsewhere, because you look at the league table, you look at the results, you look at teams' form, teams' personnel, some of the teams we've got to play as well. So you're constantly in the know and understanding of what's happening elsewhere. We have no control over that. I've got certainly no control over that. All I can control is our intent and approach to each and every training session, each and every meeting we have, each and every game. And that will continue in the right vein until something happens at the end of the season where either we are successful or we've failed in terms of what we started out to do.
I get that, but you take the inference of my question, which is that every goal has a consequence. Some bring a positive flow for you. Others, you're going, oh, no, if only they could have hung on there and things. I mean, it's... listen, we all know the score at the start of the season, don't we? Three teams go up, three teams go down. Those three are the unfortunate ones, and you don't want to be one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to find a way to stay level. Even though we drew the game on Tuesday night against the champions elect, it was such a high moment with the equaliser towards the end of the game. But keeping the players grounded, because when we do lose, and we do lose games at championship level, when we do struggle, they have to understand that that can't go into whatever's next. So, and that goes hand in hand with the way a manager or coaching staff or any member staff conducts himself. Trying to remain the voice of reason at times is difficult to do. Trying to understand the pressures that everyone else is under, the kit man, the chef, the physio. Everyone has something riding on what happens at the end of this season. We know how big it is for a club like Rotherham to try and sustain championship status, because it's something we've not done for the last three attempts. For 6 years now, we've been a yo-yo club. We need time to improve our infrastructure and slowly get to become a sustainable championship club. We'll only do that by staying in the league this time round. That gives myself and everyone involved with the club a little bit more time.
Yeah, we had Richie Wellens on a little bit earlier to congratulate him on Leighton Orient's promotion, and he did cite the pluck with which you'd taken that job, because I guess general perceptions are there's not much more in the tank at Rotherham, that what you just described, the yo-yo club status, is their natural position in football's order. Probably it's higher historically, if you go back right over history. You obviously saw something in there that others didn't, that there was a tiny bit more stretch in there, that one day Rotherham could consolidate-ish their position at championship level.
Yeah, you have to believe in your own ability. You have to believe in people. You look at other stories elsewhere, Coventry, Luton, various clubs at championship level who have found a way of staying in the league, by hook or by crook, finding a way of just keeping their championship status for a certain period of time whilst you figure it out, whilst you learn more and more, whilst you get the players in you need, whilst you wait for the investment which every club needs at championship level. We'll always be in a certain bracket of championship status or championship levels. We're in the brackets alongside the Wiggins, the Blackpools, who have always been strong League One clubs and then struggled at championship level. But we're trying to change that. We're trying to change the mantra. We're trying to change the narrative. We're trying to start a new journey as a championship club, which can stay as a championship club, regardless of who's managing the club or running the club. That's certainly our aim and intentions. And there's some great examples above us. Like I said earlier about some of the clubs that I've mentioned, there's some fantastic examples that you can compete with the big boys if you get it right on and off the pitch. Certainly something we're looking to do, but we know how big these next four games will be to allow us to do that.
Yeah. Is there a switch that I suppose you'd flicked a little bit with Exeter's promotion from striving to get somewhere? You were, you know, during your time at Exeter, you were trying to get out of the top end, to, I suppose, when you had your first couple of months with Exeter, and now it's a similar situation with Rotherham, staying somewhere. They seem like very different objectives.
Yeah, but you have to understand the level of your own team. We understood the level of our team in League Two at Exeter. We were generally quite a strong team, and we were able to gain points off the back of that. Now, the moment you jump a level, which we did at Exeter to League One, you have to understand that, you know, you're up against better players, better teams, better equipped opposition, and it's no different with Rotherham at championship level. But it makes it sweeter. It makes the challenge more giving. There's so much to come in terms of what I believe this club can achieve. Like I said, we've got a fantastic stadium. There's changes needed at the training grounds. But as with every manager, and Richie Wellens will allude to it, you just need a little bit of time to get your stamp on things and get your players in and get your staff in the right position. And that's what I believe can happen at this football club. And they've shown they've done it before. I've mentioned the last 6 years have been a yo-yo club. Previous to that, they did stay at championship level. And they did it sometimes in a more comfortable nature. Now, we know it. We're a long way away from promotion and playoffs at championship level, but mid-table is not a million miles away in terms of points. It feels a million miles away right now because the points tally is so tight at the bottom end of the championship, but we're sat on 46 points right now. We're only sort of 5 or 6 points away from mid-table mediocrity, so to speak, which is an incredible thing to say. So we're not that far away, and 6 points might look like 4 players coming in the off-season, or a bit more luck with injuries and the way the games go. We don't feel we're a million miles away from it, but right now we understand what's in and around us.
And just to underline that tightness, if I might just run through this weekend's fixtures, Matt. I mean, I've already mentioned, you've alluded you're not far off mid-table. I've already mentioned that you're one of five teams, 3 points from 18th to 22nd. Actually, when I look at the top end of the table as well, from Millwall in fifth down to Preston in 11th, that's seven teams separated by 3 points as well. Let me just tell you what can happen this forthcoming weekend. Should say that Sheffield United are playing in the FA Cup semi final. By the time they pick up in the league, which would be midweek next week at home to West Brom, depending on the Borough's trip to Luton on Monday night, Sheffield United could be promoted with a victory. Huddersfield don't play because they would have been Sheffield United's opposition. Here are your fixtures then. 3 o'clock Saturday, Blackpool in 23rd. Head to Birmingham. Matt, Rotherham go to Bristol City. Burnley, you need one more win for the title. Entertain QPR. Briefly dropped into the bottom three in midweek before managing to pull themselves back out. Two wins in the last 27. Cardiff, after their good midweek winner at home to Stoke. Coventry in eighth. Entertain Reading in 22nd. Actually, Watford in 12th are only 5 points off the playoffs. They go to Hull. Norwich in 10th at home to Swansea. Wigan need at least a point or they'll be relegated. They entertain Millwall in fifth, Blackburn in sixth, go to Preston, obviously still with a chance of making the playoffs themselves. And then on Sunday, it's seventh place West Brom against ninth placed Sunderland. Should tell you as well that maybe if Burnley don't make it on Saturday, they might enjoy winning the title at their arch rivals, Blackburn Rovers, on Tuesday night. And if we're really doing the full circle, before we join you again on the official EFL podcast, there's a rather big game for Matt's Rotherham next Thursday night against another one of those teams in that cluster of five near the bottom there. Cardiff City, it's actually quite breathless, isn't it? You know, the way in which it's been lined up by Sky on TV in a game every night of the week with something resting on it. And the fact, actually, Matt, that of all those fixtures I've just listed, which is every single one over the space of the next week, there's no dead rubbers at all.
No, there's not. But we had a meeting last week with the players and we talked at length about what this league is all about. And you've just spoke about it there in terms of the demands, the fixtures, the exposure, the way it feels for the public, the way it's supported, the way it's watched across the world. And that's worth fighting for. We're fighting tooth and nail to stay in this league. We're doing everything we absolutely possibly can. And that's worthwhile because it's the best league by the Premier League. And now we feel a long way away from the Premier League right now. But in terms of those who've been through the journey of EFL football, the Championship is where you want to be. And like I say, that is worth doing everything you possibly can in your power to stay in. I'm sure every other manager is saying the same in our position or a similar position to ourselves. And a lot of players will be in the same boat. Easier said than done, but that is worth wanting to get another season at this level. And then, like we spoke about, you might have a little bit more time to gain momentum and stay a little bit longer.
We wish you well. Good luck, Matt. Thanks for talking to us.
Brilliant. Thank you.
That is it. A big thank you to Matt Taylor, to Marilyn Smith from MK Dons Sport and Education Trust, and to Richie Wellens. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating. Press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. I'm Mark Clenett. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.